WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us, sir. How are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Ah, welcome to another Monday Night Talk. It is the middle of May. Weather is beautiful. And we have a fantastic show on tap. Keep your radio dial set right to 95.9 WATD. Joining me as my co-pilot, my co-host, partner in crime tonight, Mr. Bob Hayes. Bob?
Kevin, how are you?
How goes the battle?
Great. It's great to be here tonight at WATD 95.9.
They let you in the building this time, huh?
Yeah, they did.
Bob, if folks don't know it, Bob has been on the program a number of different times. Bob also moonlights as a school committee member in the Whitman-Hanson School District. He is currently the chair, but from time to time, he likes to come in here. And also a host of his own cable show, Bring It On. Did I do okay with reading your resume?
You're great, Kevin.
Thanks. I'll expect that $5 later.
There you go.
Okay, so warming up at the bullpen right now, our first guest will be joining us after traffic is Mr. John Bradley, who is a candidate for Plymouth County District Attorney. We'll chat with him and get the details, because it is the political season. And we look forward to chatting with John, as he is here waiting to jump on mic in a couple of moments after we check in with George Brown. And we have, this should make you feel cozy, we've got a couple of individuals, Bob, who are somehow school-related. Sean Costello. Sean, of course, is a candidate for the state representative seat, to Jim Cantwell's seat, the 4th Plymouth District. And that, of course, makes up a Scituate and Marshfield. Sean, I think he's the chair of the Marshfield School Committee. I think he is.
He could be.
He could be. So you'll feel at home when Mr. Costello joins us. And then we also, on tap, we have Kathy Smith. Do you know who she is?
She's the school superintendent for the Brockton School District.
See, look at that. He hit my fastball over the fence. Very nice, yes. We'll be chatting with her as they took a little bit of a trip up to the State House last week in regards to a Senate bill. I think it's Senate Bill 2325. And this has to do with the modernization of the foundation budget, because a lot of school districts these days, it's a struggle. It's a fight, isn't it, Bob, in order to be able to get the money? While it may be a little bit different depending on whether it's an urban school district or a suburban school district, but still, the dollars aren't plentiful as they may have once been.
Kevin, if they don't modernize the way they fund school districts, public schools, as we know, could eventually go away.
I'm sorry. Is that a bad thing?
No, yes, it is a bad thing. Public education should be available to everybody.
Absolutely.
I've totally never agree. Known you to be fresh.
No. Oh.
Just occasionally.
That was good. That was a good comeback. Our final guest is somebody who actually has been on the program before. She has appeared on a couple of different reality shows. She's been on the show Naked and Afraid. Now, do you know what that show is about, Bob?
I've never watched it particularly myself, but I've heard a lot about it.
I'm a reality show guy. I dig, depending on the type of show. Some of the ones that they have these days, you scratch your head and go, really? Come on. This one it's a survivalist thing. And the only thing that you're able to do is you go out there, you have no clothing on, not a stitch. They send you out with this burlap bag, and you might have a knife, you might have a flint. You get like something of your choice. If you want to bring like a pot to boil water, and you could bring that. One person brought duct tape one time. And you have to survive out in some of the harshest terrain on the planet for 21 days. If you do that, well, it's kind of a badge of honor. I don't think you get any money for it, but it's a badge of honor. Well, she was successful not only once, but the second time. They have a show called Naked and Afraid XL, and that's where there's like a group of people go out, and you have to survive 40 days. Again, it's a badge of honor if you're able to make it all 40 days. Well, it so happens she's not coming in to talk about that show. Like I said, she was actually on the program. She actually came in studio. She's a native of New Hampshire, but she has a new book. She's the author of The Modern Guide to Knife Making, and I'm a big fan of the show Forged in Fire. You ever see that show?
No, I haven't, Kevin.
That's where you actually you make a knife depending on the type of metal. If it's steel, it might be you never know. And you have to be able to forge a knife out of it. Not only create it, draw it up, then somehow... I think Ben wants to pop on. We get traffic coming up in a minute, Ben?
We sure do.
Were you going to say something about Forged in Fire?
I was. First of all, it's an awesome show. And not only do you have to make a successful blade, but then it has to survive all the rigorous quality control testing, yes, which not many of them do.
Not many of them do. You know, there's like a crack in it.
And that's the fun part.
That is the fun part.
Ben, didn't you think that Kevin would be more of a Storage Wars, a Shipping Wars kind of guy instead of Naked
and Afraid?
It's
funny you mention that. We actually had a couple of people from Storage Wars on here, too.
I mean, don't take it away. That was a great show, too, in its own right.
It still is.
Absolutely. I haven't watched it in a while, but, you know, I don't have TV, so what do I know?
Even though there's a question as to how authentic it is and if they plant some of the stuff that they find, but...
Some of that stuff is legitimate, though. I know people that do that, and they actually find safes in there sometimes with just cash. It's unbelievable.
Well, I'm actually putting my directional on to pull into the WATD Traffic Center, Ben, which is being brought to you by Brendan's Smoke Shop, online at brendansmokeshopma.com with locations in Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, and now in Pope's Island, New Bedford. And helping us get there right now is Mr. George Brown. George, are you there?
Yes, I am, Kevin, and we're seeing a lot of volume leaving the city right now. It's a slow ride from the tunnel right down through Savin Hill, then to Ponset Circle, down to the Braintree Split. Once you hit the split, Route 3 southbound, you've got delays now down past Union Street. Then it breaks free the rest of the way down along the South Shore. Northbound of Route 3, we're not seeing any major problems. Route 24 southbound slows a bit through Randolph, then gets better after that. And no problems getting on or off the Cape right now at the Sagamore Bridge. Drunk driving is 100% preventable 100% of the time. Help create a future of no more victims at mad.org. Traffic on the nines every morning. I'm George Brown on WATD Traffic Center.
Now, I know some people are totally against tobacco, marijuana, alcohol, this vape thing, etc. But trust me when I tell you don't want to see the mayhem DUI accidents leave behind. It's disgusting. So let's all do each other a favor and make sure we're traveling safe this summer. You from around here? Then you know how it works. I do you a favor, you do me a favor, we do each other this favor.
Brennan's Smoke Shop, Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, and now on Pope's Island, New Bedford.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk, WATD. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
And we return for the first segment of Monday Night Talk. I swear that sounded like Popeye the Sailor Man, didn't it? Who did that sound like in the Brennans? I know it was Jeff. He's the master. He's almost like Rich Little, but not really the thousand voices, so to speak.
It most certainly gets your attention, for sure. For a minute there, I thought maybe Ben was doing it, you know, off.
Ben's talented, but I don't know if he's that talented.
I don't know. I'm not Brennan's talented. That's a special thing right there that he does. I love it, by the way.
Oh, yeah. And he, like, walks into the place and it's like, all right, I'm ready to cut a spot. And usually everybody has to drop what they're doing so he can cut a spot.
Jeff's kind of a one-take guy. That's what I love about him.
He is a one-take guy, but he's brilliant with the commercials.
It's all good.
Joining us right now is a gentleman who is running for Plymouth County District Attorney. We have Mr. John Bradley. Welcome to Monday Night Talk, sir.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Bob. And thank you for having me on the show.
For folks who don't know, and I know there's many people out there who know who you are, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I am a graduate of BC High and Boston College, so I'm a double eagle. And wow. I graduated from Georgetown University Law School as well. And since I completed my education, I have been a career prosecutor. I have spent just shy of 20 years of my career in the Plymouth County District Attorney's Office. I was also a federal prosecutor for a period of time. I worked as an assistant United States attorney in Boston. And I spent the last just shy of four years of my career out in the Worcester District Attorney's Office.
Bob, do you have a question to start?
That's quite a career.
That's quite a resume.
That's a long time working as a prosecutor. You must have seen a lot of different things go on, John.
Seen a lot, and for the past dozen or so years, I have specialized in investigating and trying murder cases. So I've been lead counsel on over 30 first-degree murder trials during my career, and I've also argued about 25 cases before the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, the highest court in the state.
What's that like? What's that like being at the you know, in front of, you know, the panel and arguing your case for the Supreme Court?
Well, I think I'm a little bit unique in that I followed a lot of my own cases. So I would try the case, and if there was a conviction, I would follow the case up to the appeals court. And I always thought that it provided me with a chance to critique my performance at trial, and it also gave me a chance to see the case through to the end for the victims. And I really enjoyed it.
What is it that wants you, why do you want to run for DA? What's driving you to say, this is something that I can do?
Well, as someone who's done it for as long as I have, I think that I've always wanted the opportunity to run an office the way I think it should be run. And having started my career in Plymouth County, having had the best years of my legal career in Plymouth County, I really want to try to get in there and run the office the way I think a prosecutor's office should be run.
Okay. Bob, question?
Some would say that being the district attorney, so to speak, becomes a political thing more than a prosecutorial thing, like you've prosecuted many cases. What do you think about that?
I think the job, although it's an elected position, I think if the job is done properly, it ought to be apolitical in the way the decisions are made. We're supposed to be representing the people of Worcester County as the district attorney, and I think that a DA ought to stay as far away from politics when he or she is making those type of important decisions that you have to make. So although it's clearly an elected position, I think it should be as far removed from politics as possible.
Talk to me about yourself were part of a lawsuit. Talk to us about that and how, what it was like to kind of go through a process where you're filing suit against the person that you worked for.
It was a difficult process. It was obviously very difficult to have been fired in the first place. It was tough for me and my family. I had been there, as I said, almost 20 years. I was just about 8 months short of vesting for a pension. But I felt it was important to stand up for myself and what I believed in. And that's why I filed the lawsuit. I felt I was unlawfully terminated. The suit dragged on for about 4 years.
Yeah.
It was a long, hard process, but in the end, I feel vindicated. And if I had to do the same thing all over again, I would absolutely do it.
Bob, question? No? Okay. I just want to make sure I'm sharing the questions back and forth here. Some might ask if your suit against the district attorney's office might have something to do with your run. Would you dispel or would you give your thoughts?
That's an excellent question, Kevin, and it's come up a couple of times already on the campaign trail. And I always, or at least since I've announced I'm running, I've come out and told people right at the beginning that this isn't about vengeance. It's not about revenge. I had no plans to do this until I heard that there was nobody willing or able to step up and run. And I couldn't bear the thought of the incumbent having another 4 years to run that office the wrong way without a challenge.
Okay. And is this your first time running for an office, or have you held office, whether it's selectman, school committee, anything like that?
I've never held any other type of political office, nor have I aspired to.
Okay. What do you feel the issues of the race are going to, of this particular race? What are they going to be?
Well, I think we're at a time where we're starting to look at the criminal legal system in a different light. I think we're starting to realize that the lock everybody up and throw away the key approach to criminal justice has not worked. We've incarcerated far too many people, the wrong types of people, people who have committed lesser crimes, people who are drug dependent. And not only has it failed in stopping crime, it's cost the taxpayers a tremendous amount of money. So I think we're at a transition time in the way that people are starting to look at the criminal system.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that, because we look at the opioid epidemic, and there was a thought where, you know, the best way to kind of get somebody off the streets and away from doing drugs is to, you know, maybe incarcerate them. But there's been a different approach taken to that, where now that you have drug courts. Times have changed where, you know, you get caught with a certain amount of marijuana, well, you could go to the pokey for a bit. That's kind of changed now. It's kind of legal. So, you know, that's one of those things. What are your thoughts on the opioid epidemic and the recent vote to make recreational marijuana something that is okay?
Well, I think the people have spoken on the marijuana issue. I think that people have realized that locking people up for marijuana offenses has not done society much good. In fact, it's done more harm than good. And that's the product of the democracy that we live in. The people have spoken, and now we have to see where it goes. I think the opioid epidemic is a complex problem that doesn't have a one-size-all-fits-all solution. But I think, as you said, we're at a point now where we realize that locking people up who are drug dependent not only doesn't help, it hurts, because once they get out, odds are they're just going to start using again. They haven't been able to use while they're incarcerated, and they're suffering from a dependency, and they're craving their drug of choice, and they're going to start using again, and they get into this cycle where they can't break free.
Bob?
It is a difficult problem, but there's also many facets and many sides to that. You've got a large public contingency that says judges are too easy on drug users. The police, the fire, saying we're not canning the same guy three times a day and kicking him right back out on the street. It's breaking the budget of the local police and fire departments. And they are specifically stating, there's an outcry of people that are stating, that very opposite of lock them up, do something. Do we open state hospitals? There has to be a cure, and I don't mean a cure for the crisis, which that also needs a cure, but there needs to be some sort of a different, like you're talking about, a different way of doing it. Running back to the courthouse every day is not the right way, but I see the frustration of police and fire when they get these guys to court and they just get kicked out on the street.
You're right. It's, as I said, it's a complex problem. There's not one solution, I think, that fits every case. I think we have to keep an open mind about different avenues of treatment. And we have to, for some people, for example, inpatient treatment may work, but that might not work for other people. For other people, they may be more successful on an outpatient basis where they can get a drug like Suboxone easier, and that helps them with their dependency. So I think we can't fix in on one particular thing at this point, because there isn't one magic thing that's going to help us get over this problem. We have to keep an open mind and treat every case on an individual basis.
Again, you're listening to Monday Night Talk here at 95.9 WATD. And our guest for this segment is Mr. John Bradley. He is looking for your vote for the Plymouth County District Attorney. Right now, you don't have anybody who's seeking your party's nod. So right now it's all you, right at this moment, right? Or do we have other suitors for the Democratic nod?
No, that's correct. I'm actually an independent.
Oh, see? You learn something new every day. So basically you're looking to November at this moment. Which is important. He was talking, Bob was talking a little bit about, you know, the folks who are addicted. Let's talk about the folks who are the dealers. Let's talk about the folks who are committing the heinous crimes, and where these individuals are. Well, they get apprehended by the police, and thanks to bail or for some reason are back out on the streets. Is there something that the Plymouth County DA's office, the district attorney's office, can do, or any kind of conversation that can be had with state officials to toughen laws to be able to keep somebody, that you suspect, especially a repeat offender, in custody?
Well, I think we need to allocate most of our resources on the serious violent crime.
Mm.
I think the violence that has plagued our society needs to be cracked down on very hard. We need to take a hard line on that. I think we need to take a hard line on drug traffickers, particularly those that are trafficking in heroin and fentanyl.
Yep.
Those drugs are literally killing people.
Carfentanyl.
Yes, carfentanyl on our streets every day. And I think those are the types of people we need to be locking up. A lot of the people, for example, that come into the district courts don't have those issues. They're charged with lesser crimes. And I think those folks need to be looked at through a different lens. We can't treat them the same way that we treat the hardened criminals, the people that are out there committing the violent acts. And I think if you allocate the resources properly, you can keep our community safer and also eliminate a lot of the clutter from the courts. You can get people the help they need and save the taxpayers money.
Probably the one important question I need to ask, and that is, you're elected in November. What are some of the things that you'd like to change, whether it's how investigations are conducted, prosecuting cases, maybe even public outreach services that are provided? What would you like to do to put that you feel that need to be enhanced or changed?
Well, unfortunately, Kevin, you don't have enough time on your show for my answer to that general question, but a couple of my signature issues I'll talk about.
Please
now.
Do.
One of them is bail reform. I think our bail system, our system of cash bail, is badly broken. If I'm elected, I want to use my voice and my prosecutorial bona fides to spearhead an effort to eliminate cash bail. We've created, in essence, debtors' prisons across the Commonwealth, where people who are charged with misdemeanor offenses can't cobble together, say, $500 or so, and they are held at local jails, sometimes for periods of time up to 6 months, a year, for offenses that they would never receive jail time had they pled guilty or been found guilty by a jury. And that's wrong. It's immoral, it's illegal, and it's costing us a lot of money. Our pretrial incarceration system in this country costs us $38 million a day, $14 billion a year.
Wow.
So we have to strike a balance between keeping our community safe by only locking up those who present a danger to the community prior to trial and or present a serious risk of flight having committed a major felony. So that's one of my signature issues. I want to clean up the bail system. I would like to put in place or help the legislature to understand that we need a system more like the federal system, where there's no such thing as cash bail. You're either detained prior to trial or you are released. And that's one of my signature issues. I also believe that we need to crack down more on illegal guns that are all over our communities and typically used in the most serious violent crimes, in our murders, in our assault to commit murders. We need to have a state police detective, I think, in each DA's office assigned specifically to try to ferret out illegal guns in the community. Every illegal gun that is found, we need to make sure a trace is done to see where that gun has come from. And I think we can better understand the problem. I mean, fundamentally, we want to make it harder for people to kill one another. And the usual weapon of choice in our murders is the firearm,
yep.
the illegally gotten firearm. I think we need to get out of this mindset of these broad-based policies when it comes to different kinds of cases. We need to consider the human factor. Each and every individual that's charged with a crime has his or her story. Criminal records are much different from one individual to the other. And I think broad-based policies such as we don't break down this type of case, where we will break down another type of case, we need to get rid of those. We need to certainly have some guidelines in place, but we need to consider each case on its individual merits. And those are just a few of my ideas moving forward.
That's fantastic. You know, if I had known better, I think I would have booked you for a half hour.
Well, thank you.
But there's so many candidates, so little time, and I apologize. As you see, there's already somebody warming up in the bullpen ready to take your spot.
I see.
So
that
he can talk about his campaign. If folks want to find out more information, what do you got in the ways of a website or social media? How can people learn more about you?
I would suggest that they go to my website, which is my name, John Bradley, the number 4DA.com. And I'm also on Facebook. And I hope that people will pay attention to this election. I think people are just starting to realize how important the district attorney's job is, how powerful that position is. The district attorney is the chief law enforcement officer in the county. And I think in the upcoming elections, there will be a lot of media attention surrounding the DA's races across the Commonwealth. And I think that's a great thing.
John, thank you so much for coming in. And we'll look forward to talking to you more, as whether it's to do another segment, whether it's to do a political forum, whatever it may be. We're looking forward to hearing more from you.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Bob. And I hope your station will encourage some debates.
Okay. That's a given. We love having the public, especially, trust me, it's the one thing that Christine James definitely enjoys, is the opportunity not only to inform the voters, but also hear what the candidates have to say. That's kind of what we are here for.
That's terrific.
It's important.
Thank you very much.
Excellent. We look forward to talking to you more.
A lot of great ideas. I never knew about debtor's prison. That's why I come on your show, Kevin. I learn something new every single day, and that makes sense to me. I'd never even never thought about that.
Sorry,
people be incarcerated.
I'll have to charge you a fee for that.
I'm okay with it. I usually pay with you anyway.
We're going to step aside just for a moment. On deck is Deshaun Costello. He's a candidate for office as well. You are listening to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
This weight loss segment brought to you by Signature Healthcare, providing a team approach to weight loss, including medical and surgical options. Here's Dr. Deborah Abeles, chief of Signature Healthcare's Weight and Wellness Center in Brockton.
When it comes to medical or surgical weight loss, patients now have more options than ever before. At our practice, we're always trying to guide patients to the option that makes the most sense for them. So for some, that may mean surgery to help them lose weight, put their diabetes into remission, or reduce the number of medications that they take. However, there are also less invasive options like our 12-week doctor-supervised medical weight loss program. Patients work with our dietitian and lifestyle counselors while receiving ongoing physician consultation to make sure they are losing weight safely and effectively.
To learn more about Dr. Abeles and see if Signature Healthcare's medical and surgical weight loss approaches may be right for you, visit mysignaturecare.org/weightloss.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Don't just listen, say something. Call 781-837-4900. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Just a quick note, coming up second hour, Brockton Superintendent, School Superintendent Kathleen Smith, as well as Laura Zero will be our guest. One quick note I also want to make sure that I make a mention of is I was asked if I would make this quick announcement, and that is Brockton City Councilor Ann Beauregard actually is going to be holding a community meeting on Tuesday, next Tuesday, May 22nd, 6:30 p.m. at the Brockton Main Library, 304 Main Street. And I guess the State Representative Jerry Cassidy is going to be joining her. If you want more info, give her a call, 774-297-4937, and tell her that Bob sent you. Joining us right now, gentleman who is currently the chairman of the Marshfield School Committee, and he's looking for your vote come, was it going to be September or November? Right now, you don't know. No, there's a bunch of people who are
right,
running this, for
this. There's two of us in the primary, so September 4th.
September 4th.
Take it step by step.
Sean Costello, who we finally were able to lure in here.
Yes.
Because he's a busy guy, and talk a little bit about his run for the 4th Plymouth District State Representative seat.
Yes, well, thank you, Kevin, so much for being here. It's always a pleasure to be at WATD. I've been here a few times over the course of my tenure on the school committee, just serving my second term now. So, again, thank you so much for having me.
Bob, seeing that you are also a chair of a district, well, it's a school district, right?
Whitman-Hanson, yes.
Whitman-Hanson. Would you like to ask Mr. Costello the first question?
What makes you want to go from that easy job as a school committee member to becoming a state rep?
Well, I'll tell you what, the school committee job might not be the easiest job in the world. You certainly know that, having been on the Whitman-Hanson board for 15 years, which kudos to you. That's quite a tenure of service. But it's a very fun job. I think you and I can both agree that it's a very fun job being on the school committee. I've had such a great time doing it, and that's why I want to run for state representative love for my community and a love for public service. I've been a lifelong resident of Marshfield. I grew up in the district, went to Marshfield Public Schools, graduated and went off to Stonehill College. My family moved to Marshfield when I was very, very young or about to be born because they wanted me to have a good education. And I certainly got that here in Marshfield, and that's one of the reasons why I was driven to run for school committee. But I've decided to run for state representative because I see an opportunity here to step up my service to the next level and utilize my skill set to serve the community that I love of Marshfield and Scituate. Aside from serving as chairman of the school committee in Marshfield, right now, or for the last 4 years, I've worked at the State House for State Representative Bruce Ayers, legislator from Quincy, who I believe has been on the station as well.
Yes.
And Bruce is, he's been a great boss and a great mentor for me for the last 4 years. I'm his legislative director, and it's taught me a lot about how to get things done at the State House. And I think that experience in local and state government makes me uniquely qualified to run for the seat, and that's why I wanted to run, to bring that level of experience to replace somebody like Jim Cantwell, who's been a phenomenal state representative for this area for the last 10 years.
You're talking about a guy, those are big shoes to fill. Not that you're necessarily looking to fill them or walk the same path, mm-hmm. but there were a lot of different things that he was an advocate for, mm-hmm. for the South Shore, and worked well with the other legislators down here on the South Shore, which mm-hmm. was good. I mean, we see what goes on down in D.C., mm-hmm. and how we get all the infighting and mm-hmm. folks, whether you're on the left or you're on the right. I don't even think there's anybody in the middle anymore. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about some of the issues that you're already hearing from residents, or some of the things that you're aware of being somebody from Marshfield mm-hmm. that you feel is going to be an important part of your campaign mm-hmm. and that as a legislator if you're mm-hmm. successful.
Sure. So I think you hit the nail on the head with two things right there. First and foremost is that Jim Cantwell really has been an unbelievable representative and has had his hand in so many different issues and has really gotten to know the issues that face this community and taken them on in a way that we really haven't seen before. I'm lucky to count Jim as a friend. I worked on his campaigns when I was younger and learned a lot from watching him and having the opportunity to work with his office at the State House for the past 4 years as well. The other thing that I think you hit the nail on the head on is the further polarization of our politics, where you're either on one side or the other and there is no middle ground. That's not how I operate. That's not how I've operated in my time at the State House or in my time on the school committee, and that's not how I would operate as a state legislator. Good ideas can come from anywhere, and I think we have to work together and find common solutions. I have a proven record of doing that. There's a few fellow school committee members who I'm not on the same side of the aisle on, but we work incredibly well together. I'm lucky to count them as friends, and we've accomplished a lot of good things together, most recently the passage of universal tuition-free full-day kindergarten here in Marshfield, which is an accomplishment that we've been working on for 3 years since I was elected. I'm very proud to have that accomplishment under my belt. I know it's something that's a topic of conversation in Scituate as well, but we're very proud to be offering that service here in Marshfield. 83% of school districts in the entire Commonwealth were offering universal tuition-free full-day kindergarten. We were starting to risk falling behind. We provide outstanding education here in Marshfield. But very proud to see that the town has stepped up, accepted our proposal, just passed a few weeks ago at town meeting, which makes me very proud.
I have to ask, and that is, why do you want to become a state rep? You're going to miss being in the throngs on town meeting floor, presenting your budget for the school system.
Well,
aren't you going to miss that?
If you're doing the job of the state rep correctly, then
you'll still be there.
And you'll still be directly or indirectly involved in everything, you know, bringing resources to your district one way. And I've been talking to school people about this too. Very gratified to have a lot of friends that I've made through the school district and people that I've worked with. I've told them that if I'm lucky enough to be elected state representative, I would have the opportunity at a new level to bring in much needed resources to our school district. Right now, Marshfield is incredibly underfunded, in my opinion, in terms of our state funding, where in 2005, you probably know this, they passed ed reform and it changed the funding formula. And it negatively impacts Marshfield and Scituate, where beforehand, and I can speak, of course, all day about it from a Marshfield perspective, but we were 60% funded from the town and 40% funded from the state. Since the formula was changed, we're 85% funded from the town and only 15% from the state. So we need an advocate up on Beacon Hill who knows those statistics, who knows that Marshfield and Scituate deserve better from the state, and who can fight for every cent.
You may want to tune into the segment after the top of the hour, Sean, because we're actually going to be speaking with the school superintendent in Brockton, Kathleen Smith, as she was part of a big rally. They had school committee members, parents, as last Thursday they went up to the State House and not only held a rally, but they also sat in session in regards to Senate Bill 2325, an act to modernize the foundation budget for the 21st century. And we're going to chat with her about that, and it's going to be quite in-depth because they also, the city of Brockton right now, and there's a couple of other communities that are getting in on an equity and education lawsuit to make sure that that the state is not only properly funding education, but it's not something that stops after so long, where
right.
they, you know what I mean? Especially when you're talking about unfunded mandates.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely, which continue to grow year after year, and it's a growing problem.
But
it's great. You touched on a subject that is near and dear to me that we run into all the time about coming to this middle ground. We have people that want to be on one side of the coin or the other side of the coin because they're party affiliation.
Right.
And I've said for years, in small town politics, small town bring on, whether it's school committees, whether it's selectmen, we have to do what's best for the people who elect us as a whole.
Absolutely.
How do you keep that on an equal and firm basis so we don't get this problem of whether it's right or wrong, I'm here, you're there. Mm-hmm. We have to come together as communities and work together.
Mm-hmm.
And you hit the nail right on the head, being a school committee member. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest budgets for every single town is the school budget.
Right. It's about half of our budget in Marshfield, and I know it's a very similar situation in Scituate as well. Yep, so. Absolutely. It's you know, I think the number one thing that a state representative needs to maintain to ensure that we're being accountable is accessibility, right? We have to make sure that our number one duty is always being in communication with the people that we're representing and that we're staying in touch with them, because the second that we fall out of touch is the second that we really shouldn't be in office anymore.
Sean, I think one of the questions that I need to ask you, seeing that both Scituate and Marshfield, the coastal coalitions,
yes.
and whenever we've got a big storm coming in, you usually can see a news truck somewhere, somewhere near one of the seawalls, whether it's up in Scituate or down in Marshfield. Talk to me about, you know, being an advocate for funding when it comes to coastal situations, being somebody who'll be willing to go down to D.C. and talk on the National Flood Insurance Program, or if there's ever another erroneous issue with the FEMA flood maps.
Right, right.
Talk to me about that.
Sure. Well, it's a loaded question. I'm certainly happy to speak to it. I think Jim Cantwell has done a phenomenal job on this issue as well, and this is just one of the many areas where he leaves big shoes to fill. I live in Wrexham, the Wrexham neighborhood of Marshfield. I'm a little less than a mile from the beach. I am not in a flood zone. The house I grew up in, where my mom still lives, is on Webster Street in Marshfield Center. No real body of water super close to it, and she's a couple of miles from the beach, and she's in a flood zone. So it's very confusing science, and it's faulty science, and we've heard that over and over again throughout the years, that it is faulty science, and our state representative has really set a precedent for going down to D.C. and advocating for the constituency. I think that's an important tradition to carry on. I also think that we have a few things that we absolutely know for certain, including the fact that we have rising sea levels, that we have coastal infrastructure that needs improvement, and that we're having significant worsening storms every year. One of the things that I'm proud of in terms of my professional position now at the State House is that my boss is one of the leading members of the Coastal Coalition. He represents the Squatom community in Quincy, so those issues of coastal resiliency are not new issues to me, and he's been involved with that coastal coalition for a long time. If I'm lucky enough to be elected state representative, the first body that I would join in the House of Representatives is the Coastal Coalition. Take an active stance in that. I also think we need to look to the true experts in these fields. You can look at my friend Joe Rossi, who I've known for a number of years.
Joe, who is a time-to-time co-host.
Yes, I listen, and he's always Joe. Very good. Yep, Joe is a good man, and he knows this issue. And one of the things that he recently suggested was taking a similar model of the dam and seawall fund that was created. It's a little over $100 million was bonded into this fund, thanks in part to Representative Cantwell and other legislators who were sponsors of that legislation. And take that model and create a program to give grants or low-interest loans to people to raise their homes. If I'm lucky enough to be elected again, I think that one of the first things that I would do is work with Joe and other experts in the field to file that as legislation.
What are voters saying to you? Folks who know that you are out there now campaigning, mm-hmm. doing standouts, mm-hmm. maybe holding coffee hours. Mm-hmm. What are they saying to you?
Well, I think people are concerned with the, like we discussed earlier, the further polarization, the tone in our politics. I think it's important for our leaders at the local, state, and federal level to remain positive and optimistic and continue to do the work that they are tasked with, not throw bombs, although certainly if it's appropriate, but to make sure that they're looking towards the future and being proactive. And I've talked to a lot of people about a whole lot of issues. Flood insurance, the National Flood Insurance Program, is certainly one that comes up quite often. And it's I think it's a level of uncertainty where it has to be funded now by July 31st. There's been all sorts of short-term funding on the
You've had
level.
The can kicked down the road a few times.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And this presents
kicked down the road some more, too.
Hopefully this presents an opportunity for some real reform and for a multi-year solution, because that stability is important. People are also concerned with the opiate crisis. You know, it's stealing a generation, and it's getting worse. And people want to see leadership on that as well. Being on the school committee, I feel as if you and I are on the front lines. We have the ability to impact education and make sure our young people are educated on the dangers of opiate abuse and the fact that it can and has led to death. One of the major things that I've been pushing for on the school committee and I'm still pushing for is the implementation of health curriculum at the elementary level. There is no requirement for that at the statewide level. And I think there should be. And that is something that I would be an advocate for at the State House as well. So those are just two of the many issues that I've discussed with voters. And again, I think the most important thing you can do on the campaign trail is be accountable and have those conversations, or else you're not doing it the right way.
Again, you're listening to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. And we have Mr. Sean Costello, who is here. He's looking for your vote come the September 4th primary. Mm-hmm. And it's been great. Another segment that probably we could have gone another 10 or 15 minutes with. Anything that you want, anything that we have not had a chance to touch upon that you could talk about for a minute, or if folks want to find out more about your campaign, you pick.
Sure. Well, I'm again very grateful to be here on the show, and it's an honor to have the opportunity to run to serve the people of Marshfield and Scituate at the State House. I've been an advocate for our students, our teachers, our parents, and our taxpayers here in Marshfield for over 3 years now on the school committee. And I hope to continue that advocacy, not just on education, but on all the important issues at the State House as a state representative. If people are interested in learning about my campaign, they can visit my website, seanforrep.com. That's S-E-A-N, and then it's F-O-R-R-E-P.com. It's also accessible via email, seanforrep@gmail.com, or they can call me. My campaign line goes to my personal phone directly, which is 339-793-9116.
It's interesting that we see Jim Cantwell leaving office, Tom Calter. Mm-hmm. So isn't it refreshing that at least we're going to see some new faces?
Certainly some clout that has been lost for the South Shore, but indeed, that's why it's so important to elect somebody like myself who has experience in that building, who has experience at these levels of government, and who knows what they're doing to hit the ground running on day one.
See, the only sad note here is, there's a positive and a sad note. Well, Jim Cantwell is leaving. Tom Calter is leaving. It leaves Josh Cutler alone as the lone member of the law firm of Cutler. Cutler, Calter, and Cantwell.
The three C's.
You can very aptly fit in there.
Absolutely.
Costello,
there you go.
Cutler.
Absolutely.
You're going to find someone else with the C.
Absolutely.
Kind of go from there.
That's right.
Sean, thank you so much for coming
in. Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate it.
Best of luck, and best of luck to all candidates who are, you know, taking the time to get out there and run for office. Everybody should, I mean, that's the idea, getting involved, wanting to make a change. It's very important. We're going to step aside. We're going to close out this first hour of Monday Night Talk. And when we come back, we'll speak with Kathleen Smith from the Brockton Public School System. You are listening to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.
The South Shore's breaking news, weather, and traffic station.
95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
This weight loss segment brought to you by Signature Healthcare, providing a team approach to weight loss, including medical and surgical options. Here's Dr. Deborah Abeles, Chief of Signature Healthcare's Weight and Wellness Center in Brockton.
When it comes to medical or surgical weight loss, patients now have more options than ever before. At our practice, we're always trying to guide patients to the option that makes the most sense for them. So for some, that may mean surgery to help them lose weight, put their diabetes into remission, or reduce the number of medications that they take. However, there are also less invasive options like our 12-week doctor-supervised medical weight loss program. Patients work with our dietitian and lifestyle counselors while receiving ongoing physician consultation to make sure they are losing weight safely and effectively.
To learn more about Dr. Abeles and see if Signature Healthcare's medical and surgical weight loss approaches may be right for you, visit mysignaturecare.org/weightloss.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome back for the second hour of Monday Night Talk. We have a great hour for you. The latter part of the hour, we have Laura Zera. Laura is an author, and also, you might have remembered, she's been on the show, and she's been on the reality show Naked and Afraid, and recently appeared on The Price is Right. She's going to be joining us to talk to us about her new book called Modern Guide to Knife Making. But we start with a good friend of the show, as she's going to chat with us about a trip to the State House that was made. It is budget time here in the Commonwealth, and we have a Brockton Superintendent of Schools, Kathleen Smith. Bob, you looking forward to this conversation?
Oh, I'm looking forward to it, Kevin. I can't believe we have someone with us that knows so much about foundation budget and how to modernize it. It's awesome.
Well, if only the folks up at the State House, if only our leaders up at the State House understood the importance. Wouldn't you agree, Superintendent?
Well, I would agree, and I'm really pleased to tell you that going back, I want to say starting in 2014, we made a commitment, meaning the Brockton Public Schools, and I know many of my colleagues around the state made the same commitment. We were very pleased that we had an opportunity to speak about the foundation budget, the things that were working and the things that weren't working after 25 years. So to be there last Thursday, and I'm really excited to talk about that with you, and to really listen to our state senators, and knowing the support that we had in the Senate chambers was really heartwarming and good for kids throughout this Commonwealth.
Kathy, if you could tell us about Senate Bill number 2325. What is that?
2325 is the Senate's version for putting forward the recommendations from the Foundation Budget Review Commission. As I said, it was a commission put together of elected officials, superintendents, many people involved in the education sphere back when Deval Patrick was actually governor. And we spent a year going around the whole state, and there were opportunities through hearings for urban districts, suburban districts, rural districts, regional districts, everybody to come together and talk about what was working and what wasn't working. And as a district, one of the commitments we made was to attend every one of those hearings around the state and talk about, and this is what 2325 is about, What happens with special education students under the foundation formula? What happens with the cost of educating English language learners? What happens with the cost of economically disadvantaged? What about the inflation rate when we put together foundation budget? What about the stress on budgets with health insurance? So many of these issues, when the committee ended, and I want to say the recommendations came forward in the fall of 2014. And when Governor Baker came on in early 2015, the report was given to the governor, and we really have been sitting on this for quite a while. Last summer, we had an opportunity to go into Boston with the Joint Committee on Education with Senator Sonia Chang Diaz out of Boston and Alice Peisch out of the Wellesley area, Representative Alice Peisch, who co-chaired this committee, and actually, again, got to speak and talk about what these recommendations mean for kids all over the state. So to be there on last Thursday and to hear many of the senators, and it was widespread from western part of the state to eastern part to the Cape, where senators were supporting those recommendations and finally moving them forward and talking about how we phase them in and what is going to be the cost and why it's so imperative to support our children as we claim to be leading the nation and number one in education.
Mr. Hayes?
Kathy, it's amazing. I've been a 15-year school committee member, and I'm up for re-election. And one of the biggest, toughest parts of the year is when we get to budget time. We talk about the foundation budget and how inadequate it's been and how it needs to be modernized, and it's fantastic because, as we talked many years ago, like you're talking about in the fall of 2014 and even before that when you guys were traveling around the state, it affects every single area. Everything you just talk about from a city like the city of Brockton with English language to regional school districts to urban to suburban school districts, it affects everybody when there are mandates that are put on us, but they're unfunded. And how do they fund them? We go to the taxpayer, and the taxpayers are not really on the same page lots of times because the deficit is so big. And you even hit on the fact about health insurance. Health insurance is rising for every single person in the Commonwealth. Well, what does it do when you have school districts when most of our budget happens to be labor?
And what's even interesting is that we're folks who are listening at home, we're talking about two different dynamics here where you got the town meeting, you got town meeting style of government in the Whitman and Hanson area, where in the city of Brockton, it's the mayor's budget that is looked at and perused And of course, there's a budget that's put forth by the superintendent to the school committee. If I'm correct, Kathy, let me know if I'm wrong. And then the school committee has to decide, what are we doing here? Do we need to make necessary cuts? Are we going to have to close a school? Are we going to have to close two schools? Are we going to have to eliminate programs? Are we going to have to lay off teachers? Things like that.
Well, you know, with respect to Mr. Hayes, who I give you a lot of credit, having been there for 15 years as a school committee member, you know, that's a long tenure. And in looking at the kind of relationship you need to have in order to do these things, this past year, having been through this for the past 4 years, it was very frustrating for me because, as you said, Kevin, we put together what's called the superintendent's recommended budget, and that goes on whether it's in Whitman-Hanson or, you know, the Brockton Public Schools. We put together what we need to run a school district, and that is looking at all of our students, looking at our programs, looking at our struggles, and how do we move our children forward in a growth model for instructional excellence. So this year, it was to the point where, I'm not sure if you're aware, but last year we started the school year minus 80 teachers. And that was not because we lost, you know, thousands of students.
Right.
That was because of a $16 million deficit. So although I could not put forward a superintendent's recommended budget, I made sure that the school community heard all of the things that we needed and that I, as a superintendent, in order to do my job, has to recommend to the city of Brockton. Now, in light of the situation we were dealing with, we actually started out with a budget last year that was about $161 million foundation budget. And this year, just to keep pace with, as we just talked about, the increase in health insurance, you know, some of the contractual increases, just operations and maintenance, the cost of doing business, we already were in the hole probably close to $7 million. And that was just to open the doors this September, unfortunately, similar to how we opened the doors last September.
I know this is the time of year where RIF notices or reduction in force notices are kind of the things that you're dealing with because of agreements with the unions that you have to make sure you notify staff, whether they're professional or non-professional. What are we looking at this moment as to what you might have to do to at least hand out the notices saying this is what we're looking at the moment?
Right. So, you know, unfortunately, in our contract, our professional contract, we have a date of May 15th to let teachers know if we do not intend to continue employment with them next year. And, of course, all of us know that as reduction in force and the so-called dreaded pink slips.
Oof.
So what's difficult about this is Brockton, not like our surrounding towns, many times the towns are done in February and March. They pretty much have set their budgets. In Brockton, we usually do not have our budget set till probably sometime mid-June. And that becomes difficult because we have, again, we're so dependent on what comes from the state, almost to the tune of 80% of our funding comes from the state. And every community is a little bit different under the foundation formula. So we are waiting for the House budget has certainly come out, and it looks like there's about another $1.3 million in it for Brockton, which sounds like a lot of money. But when you hear me talk about a $16 million deficit last year and the effects of that, you can understand why that's certainly not the number I would like to see. We just are getting word, as all communities, on the Senate budget, which definitely to me this year looks like a good increase. Unfortunately, I can't count that in because those budgets are not finalized at this point. And my school committee has taken the path that instead of making decisions on, I've made recommendations about closing middle schools because of a charter that has come into our city in the past couple of years. We are still waiting on those final decisions. So you asked about the pink slips. So knowing that today is the 14th of May, tomorrow we will have over 100 pink slips going out, and those are translating into a little over 70 positions. And the reason you have additional slips is because when you have a teaching force as large as ours, over 1,300 teachers, and contractually they have seniority on certain lists, there's a lot of movement with certifications and licensures. So because of that, you have to oversubscribe those so-called pink slips until you get a better handle on the budget.
So you're saying 100 will go out, but it's 70 are the ones that you're looking at? Is it help
at
me?
At this point, it would be 70 eliminated positions.
T- Tell me how
with
tough
the budget the way it is right now.
Tell me how tough that is, because we look at these deficits. You know, you look at this year, you're saying, you know, starting it's $7 million, but I think it's up to about $9 million. Is that where the deficit
Correct.
Is at the moment?
A little over $9 million right now. Yeah.
16 last year. I think you had a double digit the year before. When does it get to a point where you say to yourself, oh my goodness, how long is this going to go on for?
Well, you know I've been here. My claim to fame, I guess, at this point is I've been in the district 41 years. And it's very sad that I can tell you that starting back in the mid-70s when I came on board, it was the onset of Prop 2.5,
yep.
I probably can count close to 6 pink slips that I received during that time. So I want to tell you the reason I say that is I remain very hopeful. When I think back into the late 80s and into the early 90s, when you finally had the ed reform come in, the grand bargain with the state, and I saw the changes in Brockton at the time. It was obviously at the time that the high-stakes testing came in for kids. Things were a little bit different. Accountability, you know, evaluation system supported by the state for teachers, what our expectations were, you know, the math frameworks, all of these things came in. They were good things. They came with dollars. And Brockton and Whitman Hansen, and I can name all of my surrounding towns, you know, stepped to the plate. Didn't matter if you were rural, if you were suburban, urban, you had the proper funding you needed for textbooks, for class sizes, you know, for professional development for teachers, support from businesses, college and career readiness, you know, starting to infuse technology as we went along. All the right things were done so that we were able to show a lot of growth. I mean, you have Brockton High School with 4,300 kids at the time, and it was a level one high school making national news, defying their demographics. And again, many of our surrounding towns did the same thing. So I do believe when you ask when this is going to stop, we have taken every opportunity to meet with our representatives, our legislative group, and beyond, not just our legislators, you know, out there talking as we did at the State House this past Thursday. And I believe people are listening. And if they're not listening, we are prepared to go forward with whatever we have to do for equity in education, because all means all, and that's every student in the state.
When you have to hand out those RIF notices and knowing that these are individuals that, you know, they get this piece of paper, and there's a possibility that funding you may be able to get funding infused into the budget to close that gap, what is it like being a superintendent and knowing that there's possibly some talented staff, teachers, and faculty that may go off to other school districts when you wouldn't have to go through this exercise if there was enough funding to be able to retain everybody and provide the proper services?
And, you know, Kevin, I'm glad you brought that up, because two things I want to share with you on that. You know, it wasn't just about sending out a pink slip. You know, I put together a letter today in talking to my staff and, first of all, thanking them, because when I started the school year, I put, and I think I remember discussing this with you, I put 80 ribbons around the high school auditorium at Brockton High on the seats so that there were seats left vacant, and we put them all around the auditorium, not all together. And when the teachers came in, they kind of looked around, and in talking to them in convocation, I spoke to them about looking to the left and looking to the right and seeing the impact of losing those 80 teachers that had been with us the previous September and were no longer with us. And yes, I had conversations with my superintendent counterparts who were smart in hiring some very talented, excellent teachers that we were unable to retain, not because they weren't doing the job, they were doing a terrific job, especially those young teachers that come in and bring so much vibrancy to the role. So in looking at where we are this year, my letter is going out with these pink slips, and I am promising them that every waking hour we'll be advocating to make sure that we can bring stability to this district, because we don't want to continue to lose these teachers. We want to keep building, and the hallmark of what we do in Brockton is it doesn't matter what is put before us, doesn't matter English language learners, special education, a student, you know, that has come from a trauma background, just like all my counterparts on the South Shore. You know, we do this work every single day. We just need to not do it with one hand behind our back. We need the support of a Commonwealth that is certainly rich in history of how we support our young people, and they need to be very smart about those dollars moving forward and making sure that every child has an opportunity.
You are tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD, and our guest for this segment is Brockton School Superintendent Kathleen Smith, who is our guest. And Bob, I believe that you have a question for the superintendent.
Well, Kevin, it's not a question, it's a statement to just back onto what she's saying.
Yep.
When you hand out the amount of pink slip she's talking about, whether it be at Whitman Hanson or whether it be at Brockton High School, it demoralizes all of the staff. You have some of the staff that are older and maybe have 2 to 3 years to retire, and they take early retirement to make way for younger teachers that are coming forward, that are trying to get in the profession, and it demoralizes the whole staff. And you're talking about groups. Brockton High School is a beautiful place. Whitman Hanson's the same way. It's every child, every day. These people who teach these kids have their heart and soul in it, and it's not a money thing. They do it, they're teachers, because that is what they do. They're professionals,
right,
and they're great at it. And it's just, it's hard when you tell them. I mean, they come to the committee. I talk to these people. I can feel exactly what the superintendent's saying, because I see these people around town and they say, how's the budget? How's it going? And people get, when every year the budget keeps getting cut, sometimes they lose faith in the district and they will jump ship. Even a teacher who's tenured will say, hey, maybe I'm going here. Maybe I'm going there. The picture looks a little bit better in this particular district. And you lose staff that are unbelievably great. And they're all great. That's what they do.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
I would ask you this, Kathy, and that is where do things stand? Is this, you still feel that the budget that you have is something that's still fluid? Are you hearing conversations from the city's administration, from the mayor's office? Have you got any kind of assurances from the city council that when it gets before them that they will make sure they do their due diligence, and anything that is cut will somehow make it to the general fund and can be recirculated back to your budget?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, Kevin, and you know I can't wait till I get before them, because the way that the structure works here is they can't add from my budget, they
right.
can only subtract.
Right.
So we have been out speaking to the mayor, who is trying to identify, you know, every dollar, certainly in the general fund area, that can, at this point, you know, I have to say, go above foundation. And that's a discussion for another time, when we talk about Schedule 19 and some of the effects of opening a charter in our city that didn't provide anything additional in support of what we provide for our students at the middle school level, and having to offset that money in the foundation budget, the Schedule 19. So I do believe the mayor and his staff is doing their due diligence. I have had long conversations with the city council president and many of their counterparts, along with our school committee members, who are out there also lobbying, so that we're doing the best that we can as a city in providing our students with what we can provide for them, all the while balancing public safety, balancing DPW, balancing, you know, roads, et cetera. I mean, we all know what it takes to run a city or a town. So in light of that, we certainly are doing advocacy at our own city level and our commitment to our children. And we're, you know, out there, as I said, you know, doing whatever we can at a state level. And we're watching very carefully federal dollars. We recently had Senator Markey and Senator Warren here in Brockton at Town Hall Forums. I made sure I was at both of those forums.
Very nice.
To hear the support when you talk about, you know, Title I, Title IIA, all the titles, all the federal money, all of the grants that make a difference for so many of us.
What are your options? Exploring your options. I'm sure the top option is that there will be enough money, that when the mayor puts his budget forth, there'll be enough money, and if there is a gap, that eventually there's a way to be able to close it. And we already talked about the reduction in force notices and possibly having to lay off teachers, faculty members, tenured teachers. I don't know if it's tenured teachers, but just basically those who are at the bottom of the list, whether it's professional or non-professional. What are some of your other options that you have to explore?
Yeah.
depending on, you know, what you have for monies.
Before we ever even looked at staffing, because when you reduce your staffing last year, I talked about 80 professional staff members.
Right.
But we also looked at another 200 staff members in the form of support staff. So we are a large district, but when you look at that, it had a great effect all over the district this year.
Mm.
And we had kindergarten classes, some 27 in a kindergarten class with a para that was serving 3 and 4 kindergarten classes in a school. So when you continue to look at those effects, the one thing that it is really shameful that in the large budget that we have, including grants over $220 million, that I can almost tell you how many ink cartridges we're buying. You know, that is not something a superintendent should be looking at that level of
right.
detail. So I say that not to be facetious, but to talk about all of the other things. So when we look at a budget, we talk about things that we had planned for technology, and I'm not able to move forward at that at a time where it's critical that students are looking at one-to-one devices, because next year, starting in the spring of 2019, those 10th graders, in order to pass with their high-stakes test with MCAS 2.0, are taking it online, as you're aware.
Right.
So, again, you don't start that in 10th grade. That's something you start with kindergartners coming in and first graders, et cetera, as they go through the schools to prepare them so that they're able to get their high school diploma. So the area of technology, the area of curriculum, the area of supporting additional, you know, textbooks, you know, looking at, you know, supplies that you're buying. You know, there should be a certain amount of money that you're spending per student on supplies. Instead, we're talking to businesses. We're talking to parents. We're talking about ways that they can help, you know, send in, you know, is it sending in pencils? Is it sending in crayons? Is it sending in a box of Kleenex? You know, this is no way to run a school district.
One of the things that you just kind of mentioned as to part of the process and looking is, you know, what if it comes down to where it's a sizable gap that you have to close a school? It's not just as easy as closing a school, is it?
It's not. And, you know, again, when you talk about losing over 300 students with the middle school option for a charter, they don't come from one school.
Right.
And remember, as you start to look at when you have 7 middle schools, and somebody says, well, just close a middle school. You know, you should be able to, you know, control the cost by closing a middle school. And while that would probably bring roughly $3 million, which right now would certainly help with the gap, I also have to take a look at transportation, which has another cost unto itself under non-net school spending and a cost that the city has to bear. So, you know, we're a large city. We have tried to provide transportation. We have very busy roads. You know, we have about 9,000 students that take transportation, so closing a school also affects transportation, where kids are living, choices the parents have made. So it's certainly, when you close a school, you should be 3 years out in your planning. In other words, there should be time for the community to talk. There should be time so that you're making recommendations on closing a facility that are well thought out, not all of a sudden, here's our budget and this is the deficit we're dealing with this year, and now we have no other option but to, you know, close a school or to close a program or to start to phase out a school. So we are still in the midst of having these discussions with our school committee.
My goodness, you made me feel old, because I didn't realize that there were 7 middle schools. When I went to, well, it was the way the model was back when I went to Brockton schools, it was it was junior highs, and there were 4 junior highs that I wasn't aware of there being a fifth or a sixth. So it's,
well, what
I
we do
old.
Is we have our compass schools, which you are aware of. So that is north, south, east, and west.
Yep.
We weren't very creative, I guess, in those days, but it made sense. And we have added the Ashfield Middle School,
yep,
which is smack in the middle of one of our neighborhoods and has provided a nice option for that neighborhood. We also have Plouffe International Baccalaureate Academy, which is closer to downtown. And we also have it's actually a K-8 school. It does have grades. It houses grades 6, 7, and 8 at the Davis School. So those are your 7 middle schools.
Okay. We just got a couple of minutes left with you, and we really appreciate your time, Kathy, for joining us and talking about this. And you know what? You've been a great community partner and coming on a regular basis and kind of giving an update as to how things are going when it comes to providing an education, a quality education, to the students in the city of Brockton. Bob, did you have a question?
Well, I more of a statement. When you talk to her about the cost and the different things she talks about, it boils down to class sizes are going to get raised. programs are going to get lost. Students are going to get in the shuffle, and it happens. Brockton, Whitman Hanson, all of the surrounding communities, we all have the same problem. It's funding. It truthfully is. It's a funding issue, and it's difficult. I mean, I'm glad to hear that Whitman Hanson, and I know that we had solved it because we have town meetings, but it seems like every year, as Superintendent Smith said, and her problem is even worse than it is in the regional school district, to where they haven't got a budget yet. Town meetings in Whitman and Hanson just finished, so we have a budget and we're fully funded for this year. But as the superintendent just said to you, you have to look down the road 2 to 3 to 4 years because some of the stuff is unsustainable.
Yep.
And I have to tell you before I go that it's interesting because one of my very strong groups is my Urban Superintendent Network group, and we meet on a monthly basis. And, of course, we have pretty much a lot of things in common. But one of my favorite groups is my South Shore Superintendents Roundtable. There's a lot of support. We have a lot of discussions. There are many things we have in common, and there are other things we don't, but it's very supportive. So I want to give a shout-out to all my fellow superintendents who are doing the same work that we're doing here in Brockton. Might be a different scale, but as you say, Bob, we're all dealing with the same things. We want the best for our students, and we'll all continue to advocate for them.
Any updates with the equity in education? I know there's a lawsuit that's being worked on, and I know that there are other.
Yep.
No, Brockton isn't the only community that's involved with this.
No, I'm feeling very good about this. We're building coalitions. We're doing our due diligence. This isn't something that we're going to strike just for the sake of striking. You know, we're watching what's happening with the legislative level, with the Foundation Budget Review Commission recommendations, and we're also, looking at, as I said, very strategically moving forward. But I will tell you, this has been ongoing work. It's been taking up quite a bit of my time, and I'm really proud to stand at the forefront of this. And again, this is for kids all over the Commonwealth.
Bob, final comment?
Well, just to ring in on what she said, it's funny because the modernizing of the budget, the foundation budget's a big thing, but one of our last school committee members, Kathleen, we had a school committee member get up, Fred Small, and he suggested taking the state to court over unfunded mandates, and we're looking into that with other regional school districts, and we're hoping to partner up to show them that when you have these mandates and they're unfunded, it breaks the back of school districts.
Well, we welcome everybody on board, and as I said, we'll be reaching out to all districts.
Well, Superintendent Smith, we thank you so much for joining us here on Monday Night Talk. As, like I said, you do on a regular basis, and we'll look forward to more updates as they become available.
Very good. Thank you so much. Have a good night, guys.
You too. It. Thank you.
She is Kathleen Smith, who is with the Brockton Public School System, Superintendent of Schools, giving us a little bit of a lowdown as to what's going on. One quick note before we exit out of the segment. I was asked to kind of mention a ward meeting coming up, Ward 5 meeting with the City Council in Beauregard. I guess she's going to have State Representative Jerry Cassidy, who will be part of this. This is going to be next Tuesday, May 22nd at 6:30 p.m. It'll be at the Brockton Main Library, 304 Main Street, parking in the rear. If you get any questions, contact Ann at 774-297-4939. We're going to step aside, and when we come back, on deck, we got Laura Zara. She's going to talk to us about her new book. It's called Modern Guide to Knife Making, right here on Monday Night Talk, only heard on 95.9 WATD.
Is Monday Night Talk with your host Kevin Tachi on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Mohammed, you are the most celebrated champion in pugilistic history. Corsell, I float like a butterfly, I sting like a bee. I am the greatest. Yet doubters claim that Liston is too big, too strong, too mean to defeat. No place to hide. Corsair, you needs a whooping. I predict a total eclipse of the sun, and Corsair, take this for doubting me. He's down. He's out. I knew it, Corsair. You got a glass jaw.
Glass problems? I'm Peter of Tiny & Sons Glass. We come to your work, your home, or your prize ring to replace your auto glass. Insurance pays. 1-888-64-TINIES. Just call.
Follow Monday Night Talk on Twitter. Start at 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add hashtag Monday Night Talk to your tweets. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
Welcome back to the final segment of Monday Night Talk. And as we teased earlier in the program, we have a special guest joining us. This is, again, a repeat offender who has been on the program previously, but is actually here to talk about something new. I'm kind of excited about it because I'm somebody, I like reality shows, and I also like it. It doesn't have to be just necessarily people surviving out in the middle of nowhere, or, you know, people who are in a house and being crazy towards each other. But there's like a show called Forged in Fire. Big fan of folks who go into a forge and they get all kinds of crazy things they got to try to make a, you know, forge a knife from. And, you know, it's a process of whittling the people down. So we're going to talk with somebody who is now a author, a good friend who has been on the program, as he said, Laura Zara. And she is here to talk a little bit about her new book, A Modern Guide to Knife Making. Now, before she says anything, you may remember Laura as being somebody who's been on the Discovery Channel, Naked and Afraid. And she was also on Naked and Afraid XL. I think it was the first XL version, wasn't it, Laura?
Yes, it was.
Welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me back.
And now, before we get things started, I gotta do this. We must out you as a contestant on The Price is Right.
Yeah, maybe the most random thing I've ever done, and I've done a lot of random things.
I gotta say, how did you go about the process? Because I actually have done reporting people here in the local area, in the Boston area, who have actually appeared on the show. Some have done well, some not so well. But you actually, yeah. I think, you played my favorite game.
No way.
I love that. Where you pick a number, there's three items. One of them, of course, it's the car. And then there's another item, and then there's the piggy bank.
Well, it turns out it's my favorite game, too. it was funny. I had no intentions. Like, it was kind of one of those things where, who doesn't love The Price is Right?
Who
you know
doesn't?
What I mean?
Yeah.
Never thought I'd go on it, but never even thought about trying to go on it. But I was out in Southern California, and my cousins were like, hey, do you want to go to a taping at The Price is Right? And I was like, obviously, you know, you even have us who wouldn't want to go.
Right.
Never thought I would get called up. And certainly never thought I'd make it anywhere with it, but I was the first name called, and I didn't even hear my name. You know, I like wasn't even in the realm of possibility that my name would be called in my brain. So it was, the whole thing was very surreal. It still feels like a dream.
So you run down and you're on contestants row. I didn't get a chance to see the show. So folks who did not see it, so were you on contestants row long?
I think I was on it for like two rounds. The second round I got called up. I just remember getting down there and looking at the guy next to me who got called up and being like, is this the life? Are we really up here? It just didn't feel real. And I for sure thought I was just going to make it to contestants row and that was going to be it. And of all things, I guess The Price Right on handbags, like designer handbags and shoes. So I'm like,
but you're an expert in.
I'm the last person that would ever know that. but I got on stage with that.
You didn't do the old $1.
No, and I didn't do the old, like, $1 above the person who bid next to me either. So I feel good about that. I feel like I got up there, in a just way.
So you won yourself a brand new car.
Yeah, I did. I'm so excited. Wow. I'm driving around this beat-up old truck that's broken down in pretty much every state, but it was funny. I'm nomadic, so I pretty much live in my vehicle, you know, and I'm telling the people on The Price is Right, I just want a new home, and they're like, no, you want a new car, and I'm like, no, I live in my car. I want a new home, and they thought I was insane, but...
That is totally awesome. Now, did you get to the big wheel, and did you get beyond that, or what?
I did. So, I actually, like, had a spinoff with a girl. We both got, I think it was 90. And so the next round, she spun a 5, so all I had to do was beat 5, and I made it to the Showcase Showdown. And it was amazing. So the first Showcase had a car in it, and I just thought, man, I can't win 2 cars. Like, that's excessive, you know? So the guy next to me really wanted it, and like a trip to Milan, Italy in it, and a few other things. And he was just so excited. So I was like, all right, you bid on that one. I'm going to take my chances for the next Showcase. Well, the next Showcase is a Jeep. I think it's a Compass. And
Jesus.
A tow behind teardrop trailer. Like, oh, man. But I mean, I don't ever really buy many things. So I don't know. I can't even believe I made it that far in the show. And I way underbid. I underbid it by, like, I think I said 28,000 and it was 40,000, something like that. So,
wow.
Yeah, so he got the Showcase, but okay. he was really excited. He deserved it, so it was good.
So giving.
Well, I don't know what I would have done with so much stuff, you know what I mean? I can't drive 2 cars at once. But
right. Right. Well, you could alternate.
I mean, I guess so.
So let's get right into the nuts and bolts of putting together your new book. It'll be out in stores in July. Modern Guide to Knife Making. What made you want to put pen to paper, want to put out a guide? And how did you go about putting this together with the assistance with other folks who make knives?
Yeah, so I've always loved knives. I mean, knives are one of those things where, like, ever since I was a little kid, I mean, I've had this connection to them. And since becoming a survivalist, going out, I mean, if I can have one thing, it's a knife. It's kind of that thing where, yeah, you can use stone tools, but it's never going to be as incredible and versatile as a steel blade. And so I have this amazing connection with knives. Worked metal as a farrier back in the day, blacksmithing, my good friend Slim in New Hampshire. And I just, you know, so it's something that I've never done as a full-time job, but it's always just been something that I've really been interested in. And, I guess I've always wanted to write a book as well. I think that the biggest thing I've had a hard time deciding was, like, what do I write a book on? There's so many things, you know. I have so many stories, but also, like, I feel like some of my experiences and some of the skills I've learned, I'd love to share with people. I actually had a publisher get in touch with me, and we were talking about writing a survival book, and he realized that I had been doing some knife making and doing a lot of different knife shows. And, you know, he asked me, have you ever made a knife? And I'm like, well, yeah, like, but I'm not the best knife maker in the world. You know, I mean, I know all these amazing, talented individuals who are just really skilled. So I guess I just never really thought of myself as, you know, a knife maker that would write a book. But I think in a way that was perfect because I'm not at some level where my skill is untouchable by anyone else. You know, I think my big thing is with survival skills as well as knife making, this is a very human skill. You know, our ancestors lived inside by survival skills. Knives are probably the tool that, I mean, more than anything, has changed the course of the world.
Sure.
You know, the development of steel and using steel knives and weapons really changed the course of human history. So I think it's something that's accessible to everyone, regardless of whether or not you have some, you know, very expensive shop with the best modern equipment, or you're just some guy or girl out in your garage messing around trying to, you know, make a knife and figure it out. So, I just wanted to write a book that was really accessible to anyone from the perspective of someone who still considers themselves very much a student in that world. I have so much to learn really with everything I do, but with knife making, there's just so much
so much to learn, and so I kind of felt like by sharing what I'd learned and through my experience in learning, I could offer up something that really hasn't been done from a perspective of someone who is still going through that process as well.
I think you did a phenomenal job. I got, thanks to your publisher, I had a chance to kind of peruse your work, and I think it's, and I'm not just saying it, folks, because she's a friend and she's been on the program. It's because it's easy to comprehend. She goes step by step. What's really cool, talking about setting up shop, whether it's the most, you know, it, whether it's just a handful of things, or, you know, if you want, you know, the premier shop where you have everything, whether it's a power hammer and you get the best in for whatever it is, anybody can be able to follow the steps here. There was one thing, and I think I said this to you, I was fascinated that there was a difference between, I didn't realize that in order to make a weapon, you didn't necessarily just have to forge it, but that there was something called stock removal.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a huge step for someone to think, when you think about making a knife and you have to go through the whole blacksmithing process, and the setup that's involved in doing that. I mean, blacksmithing is a whole skill set. And
right.
So for a lot of people, that's enough to turn them off of knife making. It's like, all right, that's just like too much to deal with. There's too much. I can't do that. I don't have the time. I don't have the space. I don't have the money. But you don't need to do that. You can just go right to stock removal, and you can still make an incredible blade. And most blades you make, even if you're blacksmithing, are going to have some level of stock removal. So you're not cheating. You're not, you know, making a fake knife. You know, you're still making a blade. And I think, you know, it's whatever level you want to take it to. And I just wanted to make something where, you know, anyone could get in and just get out there. Because that's the first step everyone has to overcome, right? Is like actually getting out and just starting it. And once you cross that bridge, it's like, oh, yeah, okay, I can do this.
And see, here's the one thing that I think inhibits a lot of people is they're afraid to make mistakes. But the beauty in being a human being is you're supposed to learn from your mistakes, not
Absolutely.
To do it, and that's how you get better.
100%. You know, I feel that way with pretty much every single thing I do. I've had to really become more comfortable than most people with failure, and I've learned to love it because that is where I learn. And most people, I mean, even if you don't make a perfect knife, you're still going to make a serviceable blade. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But yeah, maybe it's not perfect, but the next knife, it's incredible how quickly you learn. And I almost wish for those mistakes, because if you make a perfect knife the first time, you think you own the skill, whereas if you you know, you screw up a little bit, you're like, oh, I learned something. Cool, I'm not going to do that again.
And you even have in here about showing someone how to build a two-brick forge. How incredible.
Yeah, which is something that, you know, with a small investment, you can actually have a really cool little setup that you can put out in a garage. And, you know, as someone who travels a lot, who does live out of their vehicle most of the time, it's something that you can set up that doesn't require you to have, you know, a lot of people talk to me and they're like, well, I don't have a workshop. And even if you don't have a garage, you know, even if you don't even have a space like that, you can make something and set something up, some kind of space that you can improvise with, and it doesn't require a whole heck of a lot.
What did it take you to understand different types of different metals and understanding steel? Talk to me about that process.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's something I really wanted to get to the bottom of, was like, learning about metals and how to work with them and what compromises different metals, it's something that it was very intimidating for a long time, because there's so much chemistry involved, and I was never good at chemistry. I'm the biologist. I was never great at chemistry. Mm. But it took talking to a lot of different people. You know, I decided to use a lot of resources that I had, and, you know, sometimes someone explains something in just a little different way and it just clicks in my brain. And so through talking to all these incredible people that I've managed to find, I was able to really understand kind of what was going on. And, you know, I haven't worked with every single metal. You know, I've worked with quite a few, but certainly not every one. And
you never really know when you're working with a new metal, like, was it me or is it the metal?
Right.
So, because there's still so much I have to learn. So I find, you know, drawing off of everyone else's experience and talking to a lot of people, you get everyone's experience. Sometimes people get a bad taste for a certain metal, and it's not necessarily based on science. It's, like, more emotional. So I really just wanted to have the most broad, you know, scientific, if you will, perspective on what different metals are. So, yeah, I'm really grateful that so many people were willing to talk to me and share their knowledge and experience.
If there was a favorite type of a knife, a size, handle, what would be your favorite types of knives to attempt to create?
You know, I really like smaller blades. So when I'm going out in a jungle, sure, like, I want a longer blade. When you're cutting down lots of vegetation, it's really useful. But for me, most knives are made for men, which is the number one demographic that knives are built for. And so they're at least four, the average male hand is at least 4 inches across. Mine's smaller than that. Most handles, when I hold them, I don't get a really secure grip. My hand doesn't quite wrap all the way around them. You know, I'm like a little kid trying on her dad's shoes. Like, the knife doesn't really fit well. I have very small hands. So, you know, I find that when I'm going out, you know, I've quartered, field dressed a moose with a scalpel blade. Like, I really like small blades. I don't need some giant, you know, hacking blade. I like the smaller, finer blades, and I feel like I can do all the same stuff with that kind of blade. So for me, it's like, I can make a knife that is suited for me, that's, like, tailored to fit my hand. I'm a sucker for wood. I'm a sucker for leather. I like those natural materials. There are some amazing synthetic materials that are made, but I just love the natural feel of, like, a wooden handle and a leather sheath. There's just something about it. But yeah, smaller blades for me are everything.
Okay, we are speaking with, she has a number of titles, but right now the hat she's wearing is author, as we're talking about her new book, Modern Guide to Knife Making. And we're kind of talking with Laura about some of the things that she's kind of laid out in the book. Again, myself, it's something I've never experienced, but I've enjoyed watching. It's something that, you know, one of these days, I'd like to see it probably in person. We'll one step at a time. We'll watch it on TV. We'll read Laura's book, and then we'll take it to the next step from there. What were some of the other things when you're putting a book together? You know, I thought some of the great things were some of the pictures that you have in here. There's, like, one where you're going at it with you got a hammer in your hand, and you're moving the steel. I mean, what's it like? Making sure you get the right shots, you got a good photographer who's making sure that they're capturing these moments to place in your book.
Oh yeah, I have a great friend, Jess. She's an amazing photographer, and as soon as I knew I was writing this book, I knew I had to get her.
Contact her, yep.
It's everything, you know, capturing that moment, because sometimes you only have one shot. I mean, you're heating the steel up, and I was actually making knives as I was doing the pictures, and so you don't think about it, but it's like, all right, there's instant you have to capture, and at the same time, you can't just keep doing the same thing over and over again, because you're actually working with this, you know, this blade, this future knife.
Mm-hmm.
So even heating it up, you know, you don't want to heat it up too much, because you're going to burn the steel, and there's so many things. But she did an amazing job. I was really pleased with how well she did with the pictures.
Now, there's other things in here that I liked seeing. You talk about, you know, when you heat the steel up, you actually have a chart, so you can see the different degrees as it heats up, the metal heats up.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of pay attention to that. I thought that was very clever, talking a little bit about the quench, which is really important, depending whether it's water and oil. And I didn't even realize some of the nuances that you had in here between oil and water. I don't want to kind of give anything away, because, you know what, I want you guys who are listening at home to buy the book and pick out what I'm talking about here. You know what I mean? But I liked how you laid it out, even talking about, you know, choosing a handle, the importance of your handle and creating it, or when you're polishing up the knife. I mean, you really put a lot of fine work into this.
Thank you. Yeah, well, that was one of the things, you know, in I knew how I had done it before. I also knew that there's a million, you know, you talk to 10 different knife makers, you're going to hear 10 different ways yep. of how to make a knife. Everyone has their own style, and, you know, this is the best way to do it. But I didn't want to really pick some solid way and get anyone, you know, limited in the way that they were thinking as far as, oh, this is the only way to do it. So I really wanted to encourage people to experiment with, you know, their own creativity, but also different styles and find what works for them. So I had to just talk to so many people and do so much research and kind of try to lay out a general method as opposed to sticking to like one specific way to do it. So I think that was, it involved a lot more research than I expected. A lot of talking to different people and picking people's brains just to try to kind of get some kind of middle ground that people could start from and then work off of, you know, because I think it's something that once people start, it's just addictive, you know, and it's this manageable thing where a lot of the activities I do, you know, I'm traveling all over the place and I'm going to these remote places for long periods of time, but knife making is something that, you know, you come home from work, you can go out in the garage for an hour or two, and, you know, it's this manageable, amazing skill that you can work on consistently that you can do right in your own home. So it's just something that I want everyone to have access to.
Talk to me, give a little love to some of the leading knife makers who join you, whether it was Ken or Kayla or Mike Jones. Give a little love to them.
Ken Onion made the first knife that I ever owned and has been my knife-making hero for as long as I can remember. I had the honor of meeting him several years ago, and we've become good friends, and he is just such an inspiration, one of the hands-down nicest human beings that you'll ever meet, and just so giving as far as, you know, his knowledge and encouraging people to, you know, get into knife-making. So I was really, really happy that he was able to be part of it. Kayla, I actually made, like, my first official, you know, pretty knife with Kayla. She's based out of New Hampshire. Super, super tough chick. She's actually been on Naked and Afraid, too, which I think is hilarious. she's on the XL season that's airing now, actually.
Right.
What's that?
No, right? I've been watching it, so go ahead, continue.
Yeah, she's on there. Keep your eye out for her. She's the real deal. She's amazing. Kayla Cummings. Yeah, I love her. I mean, so many people have been so great. Paul Brock, he actually helped me with some of my technical edits. He's an amazing, talented knife maker. He actually was on Forged in Fire. It's so great. I think one of the best things about the knife community is just how open and willing people are to share what they know. You know, there's not this idea of, this is my knowledge and I don't want you to have it because you're going to rip me off. It's like, no, this is everyone's knowledge here. Like, this is what I've learned. Run with it. And it's an amazing community of people that I'm really honored to be part of.
Okay, we're speaking with the great Laura Zara, talking about her book, A Modern Guide to Knife Making, a Step-by-Step Instruction for Forging Your Own Knife from Expert Bladesmiths. Anything you want to tell the audience who is listening right now in regards to where they're going to be able to find the book? I don't know if it's you have it designated for strictly online purchase or if you're going brick and mortar. What are you doing?
Well, it should be in Barnes & Noble. There's a couple other places I'm not 100% where exactly it's going to be. It's going to be on Amazon for sure. If you go to Amazon, just search A Modern Guide to Knife Making. It's up for pre-order right now. So July 3rd is the publishing date. I think it's something that I want people to know is you can literally have zero idea about even how to use a lot of tools. And my book will explain from the ground up. You know, it's just something where I worked really hard to make it accessible to anyone. So don't think you have to have any sort of previous knowledge of knife making to get into it. And don't be intimidated and think, oh, that's not something that I can do. But it's something any of us can do. If I can do it, anyone can do it.
Well, you make it look easy. So at least,
well,
at least in the at least in the pictures.
Yeah, you know, like anything, it takes practice. But getting started in that is not anything that is beyond, you know, I don't think I'm a talented individual. I think I'm just a headstrong individual. And so, you know, I think that anyone can, I think that really anyone can do it.
Now, is there, are you going to do anything as far as a book tour? I don't know if you're doing anything that's just going to be strictly in a regional thing. You'll stick in the New England area, or if you're, you've got, what does Quarry Books have in store for you?
Well, I don't have any dates planned yet, but there has been talk of doing a book tour, so I'll definitely keep you posted on that and keep up with that on my social media. So, yeah, we're going to figure out what my schedule is and then get some dates in. And yeah, I mean, per usual, I'll be traveling all over the place, so I don't think it'll just be New England.
Yeah, it amazes me every time I see new pictures of you, and you're out somewhere, whether you're roughing it or you're... It's some kind of a marathon you're doing. You're everywhere, and I'm living vicariously through you as you're doing these things.
I try to keep it interesting.
You definitely do. What are you working on other than the book? So what do you got in the works for the next couple of weeks?
Oh man, I'm doing a little bit of travel coming up. For usual, I'll be giving a talk down at Summer Strong. Sornex has a 3-day event, so I'm going down to Lexington to give a talk, and then flying up to Maine, hopefully, to get my Price is Right car. Driving down to Atlanta, Georgia, to go to Blade Show, which is a knife show down in Atlanta. So, yeah, I got then back to Montana, I think, but we'll see. It's all kind of, you know, all plans are subject to change with me. So,
and folks, you can actually follow some of her her adventures. Visit www.laurazerra.com. It's that easy. Correct?
That's it. Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, I want to thank you so much for being a fantastic guest as always. Congratulations not only on your new car. A new car!
Thank you.
But also,
so weird.
Congratulations on the new book, because again, we have many authors, a lot of local authors, and it's a privilege to be able to kind of hear you talk about this thing that you've worked on, that you put a lot of blood, sweat, and time and energy into, and get the word
Thank
out
you.
To folks so they can at least kind of share in, you know, get a chance to peruse it like I did.
Well, thank you so much. I so appreciate the opportunity, as always.
All right. Well, that's all the time that we have here on Monday Night Talk for Laura Zerra. Again, check out her website, www.laurazerra.com. I'm Kevin Tocci, and that's all the Monday Night Talk Stand in the Gang coming up South Shore Live in just 60 seconds here on 95.9 WATD.
South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. 95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com.